I would like to talk to you about the effect of just a single snake bite. Now, I know that some of you come from countries where that's a very real danger, where snakes are poisonous and you have to check in your shoes or check in the bath before you get in sometimes. Some of you come from the Netherlands or anywhere else in Western Europe, and snakes mean just about nothing to you. There was a young boy, just a normal enough kid, and one day he was out playing, just doing what a kid would do, and he was bitten by a snake, a very poisonous snake. He didn't know what it was, but he had to be rushed to the hospital, and the next few days were spent in this kind of going in and out of consciousness, not really knowing what was going on. But some of the time, in one of the times where he was sort of clear, he could hear some of the older people around, some of his older relatives, all kind of whispering back and forth to each other that this sort of thing doesn't happen to a good child. He must have been a bad child. This is why it happened to him. Good kids don't get bitten by snakes. And this stuck into his mind. And longer while he was in the hospital, there was a nurse there that just wasn't a very nice woman. And so she was always kind of giving this scowl, and everything that she would do, she would just kind of scowl at him. And she had to take his blood as part of the hospitalization process, some of the medicine they were giving to him. And she just said to him in this hateful way, "Your blood is poison. That's what it is from this snake bite." And as a kid, somehow it stuck with him. He somehow believed that it was true that what flowed through his veins was not normal blood, but that instead his blood was truly poisoned. And so slowly, once he got out of the hospital, he kind of isolated himself from people. He didn't want to, in little ways, like share a drink after someone or have people eat after his food because he was afraid that maybe they would get some of his poison. He didn't want to play sports with other kids because maybe he would get his blood on them. In bigger ways, he certainly never wanted to give blood. Or when he had a relative that was sick and needed a transplant, they knew that he had the same blood type, so thought that he might be a good donor. But he was completely unwilling to do it because he was afraid, my blood is poison, and that would, instead of helping people, the only thing I could do is hurt people. And so slowly, he built up a wall in between him and others. It's amazing what one lie can do to you. I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Kite Runner. I had some friends who moved to Afghanistan, and so they said, oh, we recommend reading this book. It's an interesting, intriguing story about modern-day Afghanistan and some of what happens there. And one of the characters in it is this young boy who, his parents are murdered in front of him, so he becomes an orphan and is kind of taken in by this guy who seems like a religious man to the rest of the community, but this man is actually molesting him. And it's a hard story to read as you go through it. And at one point, the kid is sitting talking with his friend, and he says, you know, I'm starting to forget my parents' faces and what they looked like, but I'm almost glad that they're dead. And it's just like, why? Why would you want that? He said, because I'm so dirty, and I don't want them to see me. We get that way sometimes when something has happened in our lives, and we feel like we're so dirty that we don't want anyone else to know, especially those that are close to us. And sometimes that's our view of God, that like Adam and Eve went hiding from God, we don't want God to see us. Or some people, I believe, are agnostics and atheists, not because of the philosophical reasons, but simply because they would rather not think that there's a God that exists that's seen everything that's happened in their lives. But maybe you think, well, Matt, you just keep telling stories. This is from a book. Let me tell you a real-life story then. I had a friend that was also molested as a child by a guy that people, again, saw was religious. They thought he was a great guy, but she obviously knew otherwise. And we would have late talks into the night. Sometimes I wonder if it was just because she didn't want to go to sleep. Because sometimes when she was at home, during the night, it was like she would see him walk in and do these things to her all over again. And so she kind of pushed people away. Now, she looked normal on the outside. You walk up to her and you would never even notice. Kind of like a child who had a snake bite on his leg. You don't see it all the time normally to the outside eye. They look like a normal person. Everything's normal. But they won't really let you get in under their skin. She eventually started dating this guy, and he seemed really nice at first, again, but he was also, he would kind of guilt her into doing things that she didn't want to do, or he would do the whole, like, well, if you really loved me, then you would kind of go for this, you would do what I want you to do. And all of her friends are like, why are you doing this? Like, this guy isn't good for you. But she felt like she deserved that. And that's another view that we get of God. This is just something that I've noticed. And it may sound weird to you, but sometimes I can tell what your view of God is by seeing who it is you're willing to date or who it is you're willing to marry or be around. Because if you are willing to settle for a lesser guy or a lesser girl, you're probably willing to settle for a lesser God. If you believe that this person who is bad to you, you deserve it, then you'll think that God is mean and bad to you and that you deserve it and you're okay with that. So much of what people say to us can affect the way that we look at ourselves and what we're willing to be. In John chapter 9, Jesus is walking along with some of his disciples, and they come upon a man who was born blind. And his disciples, being these like religiously trained people, if you can't tell, I'm not always excited about people who are religious. I believe in a relationship with God, but religion can be dangerous. Because then people say stupid, judgmental things like this. They ask, so Rabbi, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that he was born blind? Automatically, our thoughts go, well, if this guy's blind, then there must have been something wrong with him or his parents. Sometimes, do you get that in your own life? Of people go, well, he has bad parents, so he'll probably turn out like them. There's an American saying, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. That the tree that makes the apple, you're going to be kind of similar to it. If you're born blind, especially in that time frame, most likely all you'll ever do is be a beggar. Because it's very hard to work. And people don't expect you to make anything of your life. It's like, okay, there's the blind kid who kind of runs around, runs into walls every now and again. It's fun for us to watch, but it's not going to amount to anything. And it's sort of, you can lose like your, manlyhood of, I'm not good enough as anyone. I'm not going to amount to anything. This happens with women as well. In the book of 1 Samuel, there's a woman named Hannah, and she's married to a guy named Elkanah that has two wives, Hannah and another one, Peninnah. Now, in most Western countries anyway, it's illegal to be married to two women. I would just like to say, we don't encourage being married to two wives. You'll see some of the problems that causes, but it happens some of that time. Hannah, her husband loved her, thought she was this great woman, but she had no children. Whereas the other woman, Peninnah, had many children. And so when you have like two women too close together, they can sometimes become catty. And so Peninnah is always scorning her and mocking her. You can't have any kids. You're not good enough. And especially in that culture, in that time frame, if you couldn't have children, where was your worth? That's why a man married you, right? So that you could pop out babies. Like that was the mindset. I'm not saying this is a good mindset. But she had this where she almost had a worthlessness, and she would just not eat sometimes. And her husband was this great guy that would give her a double portion of things. If he was going to give something to one wife and her kids, he would give twice as much to Hannah. But she was still sullen and sulking around all the time, and she wouldn't eat. And her husband came to her and said, Why won't you eat? What, don't you know that I love you? Aren't I worth more than 10 sons to you? He said to her, don't you know that you're worth that much to me? And still, she was sad. And I find that sad truth in our lives. So many times, we'll listen to the people that we don't like. We'll listen to the people who are mean to us or hate us or are just trying to say spiteful things to us. But the people that care for us or the people that love us, the people that are trying to encourage us, we don't believe them. And I don't know why we do it. I don't know why I do that. And we have this strange thing where we won't believe our friends, but we'll believe those who are our enemies. And so Hannah is just sullen and crying, and she goes up to the temple, and it says, in bitterness of soul, she wept much and she prayed. She's praying, she's weeping, and she has a bitter soul. One thing I really want you guys to know, you don't have to be happy to pray. Please don't think that God is someone who only expects you to come with a smile on your face. In bitterness of heart, she's weeping and she's praying. It's okay to cry. Guys need to hear this. Girls need to hear it too. Even this week, my lovely wife Christine and I were sitting at home, and I hadn't slept that well, and there was something on my mind. I don't even remember all of it, but I was not feeling well, and Christine looked at me and said, "Are you crying?" And I had this immediate, like, wall up, no. And then, like, half a second later, I'm thinking, well, it's true. I wasn't actually crying. My eyes were slightly watery, but I wasn't crying. That was true. But it was that I put up this wall. No, no. And it wasn't the, okay, let me tell you what's on my mind. And 5 to 10 minutes later, we did. We talked about it. It went well. But we have sometimes that knee-jerk reaction of we put up a wall, keep people away, put them at arm's length. No, I'm not crying. I'm okay. And Hannah was willing to go up, and she was crying. She was bitter in soul, but she's praying. And it says her lips were moving, but nothing was coming out. She didn't have the breath to do it. Sometimes your prayer doesn't have to be this loud shout. It can be. But she's just, can't form the words, but it's there. And then there's a priest that's nearby, and he sees her, and he sees just this woman who's kind of like bent over, and her mouth is moving, but nothing's coming out. So he walks up to her and is like, "You wicked woman, why are you drunk? You shouldn't be here drunk." Like, oh, worst thing to say at that moment. But consider that if you came into this meeting and you're doing the same thing, your mouth is moving, but nothing is coming out, which we think sometimes happens in worship while people are supposed to be singing, but they're like, "I don't want people to hear me, nothing's coming out." And then we walk up to you and say, "You must be drunk, what are you doing here?" How would you react? I doubt you'd ever come back. So if anyone does that, I apologize. We don't want to do that here. It should never happen. But the way that Hannah responded to that was impressive to me, because a lot of times when someone else, we're trying to do the right thing, and then someone's like, "Why are you just doing this? You must be a bad person." And you automatically have that, "Fine, forget you all. I'm just leaving. I'm out of here. Because I was trying to do the right thing, and you don't even take the time to know who I am. You don't even take the time to ask what's going on in my life. You're just judging me. I'm out." That would be how many of us would react. But Hannah continues to pray, and she says, "No, please don't misunderstand it. I'm just pouring out my heart to God. I got nothing else that I haven't drank any beer. I haven't drank wine. I'm just pouring out my heart to God." And he's like, "Oh, sorry. Continue on. Go ahead." And then he walks away. She was a mother that wanted to have children, even though other people thought she wasn't worth anything. But not every mother in the Bible, honestly, wanted to have children. There's an example told to us in 1 Chronicles, chapter 4. There's a guy named Jabez. And it says that Jabez was more honorable than his brothers, and his mother called his name Jabez, saying, "Because I bore him in pain." Jabez, in that language, sounds very similar to the word for pain. So a baby's born, and mom names kid Pain. Now, I understand that I'm a man. I will never bear a child. I will never fully understand how that goes. So I don't want to minimize that. For your mothers, I respect you. Great. But if you're a woman who doesn't expect that there's going to be some pain in childbirth, you're not thinking very clearly. And I don't think that every child for the last years and years and years and years has been doing it wrong, and you blame the child for the pain. It wasn't his fault, and yet mama names him Pain. It'd be like naming your kid Ouch. Hi, my name's Ouch. How are you doing today? Or even worse, like, girl comes up, hi, my name is Susie. What's your name? I hate my life. Yeah. And that's only my first name. My middle name is Kick Me. Sometimes the names that we're given and the names that people place on us are horrible, are completely wrong. And he's like, what are you? I was born. Parents can blame their children for the parents' own choices, and that can hurt really bad. And so as a kid, you have this mom who doesn't apparently have much interest in you. And we don't really hear about the father taking any part in it. I don't know if he was gone or not, but your parents don't even think much of you. And he came to this moment of, what am I worth? What good am I? But then it talks about Jabez praying as well. You'll see kind of this thing of like someone praying, Hannah praying, Jabez praying. I believe in prayer. It's very worthwhile. And when Jabez prays, he says this, oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, that your hand would be with me and that you would keep me from evil, that I may not cause pain. He's saying, God, I want you to be involved in my life, strengthening what I do, so that I may not cause pain, that I may not live up to that name that people have given to me. Sometimes people are just expecting you to live up to whatever names you've been given as a child. And he's saying, God, I don't want to live up to that name. I want to be called by something else. I want people to know me for the blessing that I am around them. The enlarging my territory was very similar. At that time, they used tents. And so if you want to add an addition to your house, you just stretch the tent a little further or get a new canvas thing to put over it. He's saying, God, stretch that out. A lot of times that included also having family and kids yourself because you have to make new rooms or add that to it. His prayer reminded me of one by King David. That's in Psalm 69. Where David, who was a king of Israel, had all this stuff going for him. He says, may those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me, O Lord, the Lord Almighty. May those who seek you not be put to shame because of me. Saying, God, I don't want my life to be what harms others or what pushes other people back or makes Christians look bad. Now, this was actually written as a song and was part of their songbook. So think of it like if we came in and did a worship song like this, that'd be kind of awesome. Like, may those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me, because of me. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You always have to throw in a whoa, whoa, whoa for those worship songs because it just makes it sound happier than, God, please don't disgrace your people because of me. That was his prayer for it. And I would like to tell you that all of these stories ended up being happy. I would like to tell you that my friend that had been molested eventually found a guy who was worthwhile, who was godly, that they started dating on Valentine's Day and they had this romance that she had always wanted and that she got married to him. I would love to tell you that the man who was born blind, that Jesus' response to his disciples was that it wasn't the sin of him or his parents, but that it happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. And before that day was done, that man could see. And there were people who were saying to him, wow, I didn't know your eyes were brown. Your eyes look very nice. I would like to tell you that Hannah had a son, and not just that one, but had more sons and had more daughters, and that she wasn't seen as this barren woman who was worth nothing, but that God gave her more than she could have asked for. Or I'd like to tell you that Jabez was not known for his pain and that God answered that prayer. And I would tell you that, and I will tell you that, because that's what happened in each of those circumstances. See, the question is, what kind of God do you believe in? Like I said, there are some people who just don't want God to see them because they feel so shameful. Some people who expect a God that's not going to be good to them because that's what they feel like they deserve. Or do you believe in a God who's better to you than you deserve no matter what it was? Psalms 113, there's this rousing thing of who is like our God, the one who sits enthroned on high, who stoops down to look on the heavens and the earth. He raises the poor from the dust, the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes as a happy with the princes of their people. He settles the barren woman in her home as a happy mother of children. Praise the Lord. That the poor he lifts up, that the needy he lifts up, that ones who feel like they weren't worth anything because they weren't mothers, that he gives them things, that those who felt like they were nothing are then treated like princes. This was actually the funny part to me. As I was putting this together, I remembered this verse, but I couldn't remember where it was. So I start looking around. I thought it was in Psalms somewhere. I read like through Psalms 1 through Psalms 100. There's 150 Psalms. I'm just looking. I'm like, oh, I can't find it. So I go to Google because when you need to find something in the Bible, go to Google. I remembered a little bit of the phrase. So I typed in the phrase and I was able to find it. I'm like, great, Psalms 113. The next day in the morning, I was praying and I felt like I was supposed to read the part of Hannah's life again. So I went back to 1 Samuel and I'm reading through that. And I'm like, well, okay, I read the part of she has a kid, but then I'll keep reading a little bit. And Hannah has this prayer that she prays. And in 1 Samuel 2, this is what Hannah prays. There's no one holy like the Lord. There's no one besides you. There's no rock like our God. Those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who are hungry no more. She who is barren has borne 7 children. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. Almost the exact same thing. I'm like, God, why do I use Google when I should just use God? I wasn't listening that well. But it was such a confirmation to go, this is what God is wanting to get across to you. If you feel like you're poor, if you feel like you're needy, he's the kind of God that lifts you up, not the kind of God who's trying to make you feel bad about who you are or what happened to you. He's the kind of God who wants to seat you like a prince, that if he's the king, he wants to make you his child as a good father that feels like you're worth something. And we see Jesus talking about himself that way. In Luke 4, Jesus says, my purpose in coming was to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight for those that were blind, and release for the oppressed. In Luke 6, Jesus is saying, blessed, or sometimes translated happy, happy are those who are poor. Happy are the hungry. Happy are those who weep. Happy are you when you're hated, when you're excluded, when you're insulted, when you're rejected. He looks at those who have nothing and says, this is good. These are the people that I want. I have seen you, I have known you, and I have wanted you, and you're worthwhile. But this isn't just a positive, like, oh, think positive about yourself. Please don't mistake me as a just say yes to your life kind of person. I'm not saying that this is just, oh, some happy, feel-good thing. All of this happened because of Jesus, that he is the center of it, that it's not, oh, go out and try and find it on your own. I'm saying you will find in Jesus this God who is good. You will find in Jesus this one who cares about you. In Isaiah 53, there's this prophecy about what Jesus was going to be like and what he would do. And it said, Jesus was despised and rejected by mankind. He was a man of suffering. I mean, he knows it. He gets it. He was familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised. Have you ever felt like people like turn their eyes away from you? They don't want to look at you because like, oh, you did something. And there's just that distance that I don't want to look at them. Stay away from them. We held Jesus in low esteem. Surely he took our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God. Sometimes we think that those that are actually serving God are punished by God. Then we go, oh, something bad is happening to them. They're punished by God. When this was actually God's whole purpose the whole time was that the punishment that would be on Jesus would take away the punishment from us. We considered him stricken by God and afflicted. Jesus was afflicted for you, for us. I've had more than one friend that was a cutter, that they would self-inflict wounds on themselves. It's a hard thing. I haven't been them. I know that I cannot tell you exactly what's going through their minds, but some of the things that they've said to me is that it's sort of like they feel like there's so much pain inside that they just have to get it out, or that they deserve it because they're so bad. And so it's their own way of trying to like punish themselves for it. What Jesus is saying is that you don't have to inflict your own pain on yourself. You don't have to do that because Jesus took all that for you. If you feel like you're trying to get the pain out, it's not going to happen because of you doing something to yourself. It's going to happen because of what Jesus did. Kind of in the Old Testament, they had this mindset of like, oh, we make some kind of sacrifice and then we'll be good enough to God. But Jesus changed that. In Hebrews 10, talking about sacrifices as though the things we could do, which could be cutting or which could be legalism, it could be doing nothing to yourself, but just being this like judgmental, stuck up kind of person. It says, it can never by the same sacrifices repeated endlessly, year after year, make perfect those who draw near to worship. If that could have happened, if you guys doing stuff could have worked, would you have not stopped doing it? For the worshipers would have been cleansed once for all and would no longer have felt guilty for their sins. If what you're doing to try and get rid of your sins leaves you feeling guilty for it, then you're not doing the right thing. Take it to Jesus. Because we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Jesus did it once. You don't have to keep trying to find a way to get forgiven of the shame that's in your life. That kid that got bitten by a snake at the beginning may very well have been something like you, where something happened to you in your life and you heard people saying, oh, you're bad. Bad stuff has happened to you because it's your own fault. And you felt like your blood was poisoned, that there was something intrinsically wrong with you that was not wrong with anyone else, and that you had to hide it inside. And that in little ways, in big ways, you put up this wall. And Jesus would ask you today to let down that wall, whatever it is that's pushed you back from that. You can be free from what you thought was your shame. With God, all things are possible. Which that so many times we hear, with God, all things are possible. And we put that to like, that somehow has to do with mountains being moved, or with you can get a healing and your body can be fixed, or you can get that paycheck in time. With God, all things are possible. You can find that apartment that you're looking for. And those are true. God cares about every part of your life. But there's an example in the Bible, actually three times, in Matthew 19 and Mark 10 and Luke 18, the same story that talks about with God, all things are possible. And it's this young guy who runs up to Jesus. And one thing it talks about him being young, and another one it talks about him being rich, and another one it talks about him being a ruler, so he is powerful. He has everything going for him. And he says, what must I do to be saved? And Jesus says, well, have you kept all the commandments? He says, yeah, I've done everything. I've done all that. I've been this perfect, good little boy. So he's young, he's rich, he's powerful, he's got good morals. He feels like he should have everything, but still there's something in him that says, it's not good enough. I'm not good enough. I need something more. And Jesus looks at him and says, then let it all go. In his instance, that was all that money, all that stuff that you thought was worthwhile to you, let it all go and follow after me. In your case, maybe you didn't grow up as rich and powerful or the good little kid, and all of you were young at one point, so everyone had the young thing. But maybe the other things you didn't. But the same is still true, that Jesus would say, if you feel like you're lacking something, you know what that is? Let it go and follow me. Let that stuff that you've been holding on to, that you've thought defined you, let that go and follow me. And the man just is unwilling to do it. He puts his head down and he walks away. And all the disciples are like, oh no, why did he do that? Like, if this guy who has everything for him can't do it, what do we do? And that's when Jesus says, with man, it's impossible. But with God, all things are possible. When he says all things are possible, he's saying whatever it was that was in your life that you felt you couldn't let go of, that's possible with Jesus. That's where it comes from. If you thought your blood was poison, I'm telling you, you're wrong. And that God is waiting for you.